From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best picks from our program on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, a question.
Is government part of the problem? Is it part of the solution?
We have a two-part cover story looking for answers. Also, James Fallows on the truth and a film some call Truth Challenged, Dinesh D'Souza's 2016 Obama's America.
He wants America to have less wealth and power so that other people in other countries can have more wealth and power.
Also, the secret history of YOLOing.
You want to park illegally in this spot? YOLO. Should I buy these shoes or pay rent? YOLO.
And later, the movie Kristen Bell, seen a million times, and Art Garfunkel, on why he just wants some respect.
I want people to go from song to song and end up going, the singer can sing.
That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. This past week, we tried out an experiment, a kind of audio Rorschach test, where we asked random people in four cities, San Francisco, Omaha, Houston, and Pittsburgh, we asked them this question.
What's the first word that comes to mind when I say the word government?
And here's what we heard back.
Government.
First thing that comes to my mind,
Stepping on poor people.
Too big.
Big.
Big mess.
Government, I think of Big Brother.
Intrusion.
Government. Taxes.
Right now, broken.
Money.
Tries to take care of everything.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
That's an impossible thing.
Now, this is just a sample, but by and large, the vast majority of people in all those places, when they heard that word, government, what came to mind was negative. And so it's probably not surprising that most polls, including a recent one in July taken by Fox News, show huge majorities of Americans who believe government is...
I think it's part of the problem.
They are the problem.
They're definitely the problem.
Right now, anymore, I think it's part of the problem.
They should be part of the solution, but I haven't seen any solutions yet. So I can only assume that they're part of the problem.
But start asking more questions, and at least with the people we asked, it turns out that a lot of them also want government to be part of the solution. Today and tomorrow on the program, we're going to explore those ideas. Our cover story today, how did government become something perceived as a problem? The message at the GOP convention this past week was clear. Government is too big, too expensive, and it can't fix our economic problems.
The choice is whether to put hard limits on economic growth or hard limits on the size of government. And we choose to limit government.
But Mitt Romney understands, like I understand, that people, not governments, create jobs.
America is about to turn the page on Barack Obama's four-year experiment in big government. And it starts by renewing our belief.
Now, there's nothing new about any of this. Anti-government sentiment is practically part of the American DNA, and it has deep roots in the Republican Party. Here's Julian Zelizer. He teaches history and public policy at Princeton.
Republicans, dating back to the New Deal, had always voiced their opposition to the expansion of government. It was always part of the party. The idea that centralization was bad, bureaucracy was dangerous, taxes were bad. You heard this from Republicans in the 1930s. You hear it in the 1950s when Eisenhower's president. But the difference was, until the 1960s, Republicans had a liberal wing to the party. They had New York Republicans. They had a lot of Midwestern progressives who still said government's good for a lot of things.
And one of those Republicans, Julian Zelizer explains, was Nelson Rockefeller. He was the governor of New York. And in 1964, at the GOP convention, he warned the party that it was becoming too conservative.
It's danger to the party and it's danger to the nation. The methods of these extremist elements, I have experienced that firsthand.
Nelson Rockefeller is literally booed at the convention when he speaks, and he's the representative of that wing of the party, and Goldwater becomes the face of Republicanism.
I accept your nomination with a deep sense of humility.
And he shifts to the right, and he takes on a lot of core social programs like Social Security, the Tennessee Valley Authority, and he argues in his famous convention speech
that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
Extremism is something that is good, that Republicans should be proud of if it's an extremism revolving around conservative values.
that moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue.
And then it's really in the mid-70s, 76, when Reagan challenges President Gerald Ford in the primaries through the 1980 election, when Reagan defeats Jimmy Carter, that those ideas from Goldwater are solidified and become the defining mantra of the party.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
It's not the solution, it's part of the problem. And Reagan wanted to kind of turn the basic liberal argument that we had seen since the New Deal on its head. And he said that the only way to really revive economic growth, to really restore faith in the country after the kind of dismal 1970s, was to do things like cutting taxes, to deregulate as much of the economy as possible. And he really had this intense animosity, rhetorically, toward what government did on the domestic front.
And since that time, says Julian Zelizer, that position, that government is the problem, that's become a kind of starting point for the American debate, something, as we'll hear tomorrow, many Democrats agree with as well.
It's important to remember the argument about government is more successful in the abstract. So people are asked this question and they say, yes, we don't like government, we don't like bureaucracy. But pretty consistently, if you ask them about specific programs, they like them. And so conservatives have been very good at kind of keeping the argument at the abstract level and more successful politically, ideologically, at selling their arguments than liberals, even though both parts, government and a resistance to government, are very much part of American political culture.
A contradiction perhaps best summed up in the handwritten sign, government, get your hands off my Medicare.
Absolutely. That it's not a hypocrisy. It's a kind of dual way of thinking and an ambivalence about what we are that is continually expressed by the American public. And politicians really struggle to say, how will people think of what government is? For conservatives, if we think of bureaucracy and the notion of government, they win the battle because the polls go against Democrats. But for liberals, if you talk about Social Security, transportation, veterans' pensions, then they win the battle. So it's really what we're talking about when we talk about government that has a big impact on public attitudes.
That's Julian Zelizer. He teaches history and public policy at Princeton. But what about the argument that government is the problem? What about that argument on its merits? Here's Daniel McCarthy, the editor of the American Conservative magazine.
It's become unhinged from a relationship with the public, and it's been gamed by a lot of interests, both ideological and financial. As a result, you have policies that are crafted by lobbyists and by ideologues rather than by sincere representatives of the public interest.
What would an ideal government look like to you?
Well, I think an ideal government would be very close to the model found in the Constitution, one that's very decentralized and that allows different communities to pursue the level of government, the size of government that they think is appropriate.
Wouldn't that be inefficient?
It would be inefficient in a sort of universal context, but I don't think it would be inefficient in terms of the particular kinds of happiness that different people want to pursue throughout the country. I mean, America has always been a country of regional and religious differences, and that's perfectly fair. It's been a country of rural versus urban differences as well. The idea that we would have one set of policies that would fit everyone seems to me inefficient in a more profound sense.
When you hear Republicans say, as we've been hearing this past week, that government is the problem, we need government to get out of the way, what does that mean? What are they saying?
Well, it's hard to know exactly what they mean because even though that's very much the rhetoric that they emphasize, the practice that they pursue is very different. So someone like Mitt Romney, for example, had his own individual mandate health care plan in Massachusetts. And someone like Paul Ryan was an outspoken advocate of the bailouts in 2008 of TARP. So I think there's a bit of a disconnect where the Republican Party is able to cash in on the fears that Americans have about big government, even though the Republican Party actually is practicing a form of big government itself.
How so?
I think if you look at whenever the Republicans have power, whether at the state level or at the federal level, they expand the things that they think are appropriate and the things that they think benefit them. Providing more resources to churches, for example, during the faith-based initiative in the Bush administration. But also, I mean, things like the military, where you see Republicans apply a totally different standard than they would to any other department. Any kind of increase in the military budget is seen as necessarily a good thing, whereas they would never say that simply adding more money to the education department makes for better education across the country.
What worries you more The re-election of President Obama or the election of Mitt Romney?
I think it's pretty much a wash at this point. We have a sense that Obama is checked by having a Republican Congress. And Republicans in general, while they tend to resist all kinds of government growth under a Democratic administration, when a Republican such as George W. Bush or Richard Nixon is in office, Republicans tend to be much more cooperative. And since Democrats generally don't oppose big government on principle, when you have a Republican president, the result is government growth.
In your view, gridlock is actually an ideal result.
Gridlock is actually conservative, yes. Gridlock is more conservative than single-party rule of either kind.
So what's the point, really, of even having legislators
that's entirely the point, because you have these legislators who come together and who have, you know, very different interests, not only across party lines, but also in terms of the regional, interests that they represent. And one of the problems we've seen, I think, is that the parties have become more closely identified with ideologies over the past century, where instead of trying to come to an agreement on the minimum necessary things, each party will pursue much more than a minimum by trying to just exclude the other party whenever it has a majority, especially when it has, you know, all branches of government aligned with it.
Why do you think Republicans have been so successful at establishing this brand identity, that government is the problem, government is part of the problem?
It's because Democrats, I think, have stopped even considering that possibility. So Americans, even when you have someone like Bill Clinton say in the 1990s that the era of big government is over, I think that the brand identity the Democrats still possess is the one they established under Franklin Roosevelt and under Lyndon Johnson. And that leaves the field open to Republicans to be the party that cashes in on pretty much all anti-government sentiment. Whether it's gun owners, whether it's taxpayers, whether it's small businessmen, when they think the government is on their back, they think that the Republican Party has to be the solution. Democrats just aren't willing to talk about it.
That's Daniel McCarthy, editor of the American Conservative magazine. All this weekend on the program, we've been asking people in America about government, including this question.
Is government part of the problem? Is it part of the solution?
And here's what we heard in San Francisco, Omaha, Houston, and Pittsburgh.
Government will be part of the solution. Politics is part of the problem.
Right now, it's probably part of the problem, and with both parties.
Both ways. I think it is a problem in some ways, and
I think it could be both. It really depends.
Well, that's a tough one. It goes both ways.
I'm going to say solution. I have a faith on them, so better to be.
Now, when pollsters ask this question, the overwhelming answer is that it's part of the problem. Yesterday, we mentioned a poll taken in July by Fox News that showed 2/3 of Americans agree with that view. But how do most people think about government? Highways, power lines, the internet, the battle against Al-Qaeda? Well, in those four cities, we also asked that question. What does government mean to you?
TSA.
I got a speeding ticket.
DMV.
The Social Security office.
The police, the fire, emergency type people.
Roads and security.
Defense, essential social services, wasteful programs.
Last week, it was Republicans who argued that government is part of the problem at their convention. And we explored that idea on the program yesterday. This week, Democrats will attempt to explain how government could be part of the solution. And that's our cover story today, making the case for the government. What most of us think of as government, or big government, really goes back to around the beginning of the 20th century, says Princeton historian Julian Zelizer, with the administration of Woodrow Wilson.
He clearly is supporting more government as part of American life. His administration includes things like the creation of the Federal Reserve. And so Woodrow Wilson, who is still conservative by modern liberal standards, does allow for a pretty dramatic expansion of government. But it's FDR in the 1930s. That's the turning point. That's the president who not only accepts and pushes for the growth of government, but tells the American people it's absolutely essential that we have a government deal with the very big social problems that we faced as a nation. And he just rebuffed his critics. When they argued government was bad, he argued government was essential and that we had an obligation to use government to deal with the kinds of inequality, unemployment, and social ills that this nation was facing. And by 1936, when he runs for re-election for the first time, FDR gives a full-throated defense of this idea that government is a positive part of American society.
Your government
is still on the same side of the street with the Good Samaritan and not with those who pass by on the other side.
And at least for Democrats, that was more or less the view of government as the main problem solver for most of the 20th century, right up until Bill Clinton formally broke with that idea in 1996 in his State of the Union address.
The era of big government is over.
President Obama is very much a product of the post-Jimmy Carter, post-Bill Clinton Democratic Party. For all the talk from Republicans of this being a quasi-socialistic administration, nothing could be farther from the truth in that if you just listen to what he says and look at the kinds of policies he proposes, he's very skeptical of government.
I have never been somebody who believes that government can or should try to solve every problem. Some of you know my first job in Chicago was working with a group of Catholic churches that often did more good for the people in their communities than any government program could.
And he's trying to use it in strategic ways, but he's always putting handcuffs on the programs that he even creates. And I think it's a pretty consistent part of who Obama is. He certainly would not offer the kind of robust defense you heard from FDR in the 30s or even Ted Kennedy in 1980 when he challenged Jimmy Carter during the primaries and made a famous convention speech.
Our cause has been, since the days of Thomas Jefferson, the cause of the common man and the common woman.
Where he really said Democrats had to stick to their principles, and part of that was using government for the common good.
But when people hear the word government, they don't necessarily think of those things. According to a Fox News poll taken earlier this summer, 2/3 of Americans say government is the problem.
Look, part of it was the conservative movement since the 70s has been very successful in shifting national debate. They've made an argument that has been more compelling to many Americans than what Democrats have supported. And so that's part of it. And part of it was just the aftermath of the 1960s and 70s when Democrats had still been in power and there were so many problems that Democrats were blamed for the problems, rather than other forces such as the global economy. And the convergence of the conservative movement and the crisis of the 60s and 70s left a space for conservatives to make this argument successfully.
Julian Zelizer, he teaches history and public policy at Princeton. Democrats today, for the most part, balance between two slightly competing ideas, that government is part of the solution, but with a public acknowledgement that it can be part of the problem. And for former Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm, who will speak at the Democratic Convention this week, there's a reason why.
People assume that government is this massive, bloated, choking, amorphous thing that takes this people's tax money and doesn't give them anything in return. People don't see what government provides. They don't understand that when you taste your food at a restaurant, somebody has made sure that food is not going to poison you when you buy it in the stores, when you drink your water, that you have clean water. It's a given when you turn on the lights that the electricity comes on. People don't understand government plays a role in all of that. But because it's unseen and assumed, that's not part of the positive side of the conversation.
President Reagan famously said government is part of the problem, which has become a mantra for many conservatives, and we've been hearing it this past week at the Republican convention. How is government the solution, in your view?
Well, first of all, as I say, there's only certain things that governments can do, especially as this conversation is unfolding about the economy. And if you have purely a hands-off, laissez-faire approach for addressing the economic challenges America's facing, then basically you're throwing in the towel, you're waving the white flag, you are aiding and abetting the offshoring of jobs to countries that are very aggressive in poaching jobs. So we can decide that government is part of the problem and that we don't have any role in it. But truly, we will continue to see the structural changes to our economy because government must have a role, whether it's in educating or in providing infrastructure help or in nurturing the sectors where America can be competitive. There is a role for government in all of that.
E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and an analyst here at NPR wrote a column earlier this summer, and it was titled Government is the Solution. And in that column, he went after Democrats for running away from this idea that government can be part of the solution. He essentially argued that Democrats have essentially accepted this argument that government is part of the problem.
It is an uphill battle to make the argument because the other side is so deeply permeated into our pores as a result of the very effective messaging that has been done. But it is such a curious form of self-loathing that that notion represents. And what I mean by that is that how can you hate government, which is the product of democracy and a constitutional structure that is revered? How can you hate the service that government provides, but love America and love democracy? It is such an interesting schism. Yes, there are problems with government, like there are problems everywhere. Let's fix those problems. But to throw government out when government is us, it's not just something that's distant, it's all of us. That, to me, is an interesting psychological challenge.
If the term government were a brand, it would be a brand in which the company overseeing that brand would have no control over it. Because government means so many different things to so many different people, right? So I'm sure when you were governor, people would say, look, I'm a small business owner, and I've got to deal with all these permits and all this red tape, and I've got to go to all these offices, you know, every time I want to hire somebody or do something with my business. And so I wonder whether you can understand that, why some people are skeptical.
Totally. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's such an interesting strategy on the part of the Republicans, honestly, because they want to slash and slash and slash government. And therefore, government is in less of a position to be able to provide the quick, rapid, seamless service that people have come to expect from the private sector.
You're arguing that Republicans have deliberately made government less efficient because they want people to think that government is inefficient?
Well, it's certainly been a self-fulfilling prophecy. In the shrinkage of government, they have disabled the effectiveness of government in many places.
Where?
For example, in permitting. I mean, just look at those issues. If you have eliminated the ability to invest in streamlining permitting, which means the investment in technology to be able to do that, then your permitting systems will continue to be antiquated. People will have to go to a Secretary of State's office to stand in line to get their driver's license rather than doing it online and easily. People will be frustrated by how many places they've got to go to get a permit because there's been no ability to have state, local, and federal permitting systems marry because the investment has gone away. And so that's one of the ways I think that there's been an effective strategy. Whether it's a byproduct or an original intent to do it that way, it's been effective on the part of the Republicans.
That's Jennifer Granholm, the former governor of Michigan and host of The War Room with Jennifer Granholm on Current TV. Jennifer Granholm, thanks so much.
You bet.
Candidate Obama said, I believe that if our government is there to support you, this plant will be here for another 100 years.
Romney backed a law that outlaws all abortion, even in cases of rape and incest.
That plant didn't last another year.
Facts can be pesky things, and elements of what you just heard are, well, factually challenged. That was a clip from Paul Ryan's convention speech in an ad put out by the Obama campaign. James Fallows of The Atlantic joins us now, as he does most Saturdays. Jim, hello.
Hello, Guy.
Lies, damn lies, and statistics, that's nothing new. But in this campaign, Jim, even going back to the GOP primary, I'm wondering whether you have noticed an increasingly cavalier attitude towards facts.
I think over the last decade or two, as many people have remarked, there's been increasing polarization of what you could think of as the fact universes in American discourse. It's not just that people have different outlooks or different values, but they seem to believe that different things are true. And I think there was a contrast of two of the speeches at the Republican convention that underscored the difference. Political speech, like advertising or like wooing or anything else, involves putting the best face on things. And I thought that Governor Romney did that in his acceptance speech. He said a lot of things the Obama administration would not agree about, that it, for example, has been apologizing for America, but that was part of Governor Romney's case for a different approach. The preceding speech by Paul Ryan had a lot of more specific claims that I think went further over the line of being not just a different presentation of reality, but different factual issues, including that one about the Janesville plant and some others. And I think this is one more symptom of the universe we now operate in.
I'm also noticing, Jim, this notion that facts, you know, things that are backed by evidence, are seen by many people as just liberal opinions.
This is a genuine challenge for the press and all its different outlets right now, because studies seem to show that a sizable minority, in some cases even a majority, of people who identify themselves as Republicans believe that President Obama was not born in the United States. And from every factual bit of evidence that can be adduced, that's just not true. But if you have a lot of people who believe that, or that Saddam Hussein was involved in the 9/11 attacks or other things of that sort, there is a kind of closed circle that makes it very hard to engage in factual challenge. And all I can hope is that the public, political leaders and people in the media will figure out how we can get through this period in our national life. I think it won't go on forever, but it's a difficult period right now.
Well, what about accountability? I mean, we heard this week from a Romney campaign strategist. He said, we're not going to let fact-checkers dictate the terms of our campaign to us. And you've also had things coming out of the Obama campaign that are factually challenged. But nobody is really being held accountable for. Nobody seems to suffer any consequences.
I think there are two important market tests, you might say, that we'll face. One will come next week when the Democrats have their convention. If their prominent speakers say as many things that cross the line as Representative Ryan did, I hope and assume that people from the media from all stripes will be there to say, wait a minute, this isn't true. The deeper and probably more important market test is the one that happens 2+ months from now on Election Day, where we see whether arguments whose proponents say we don't care about the facts, whether they work or not. So again, politics and democracy, it's an endlessly refined series of approximations of better self-government, and we'll see whether it works 2 months from now.
That's James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic. You can find his blog at jamesfallows.theatlantic.com. Jim, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Guy.
In mid-July, an obscure film called 2016, Obama's America, opened in just one theater in Houston.
Obama has a dream from his father, that the sins of colonialism be set right and America be downsized.
The film proposes that President Obama is weakening the country deliberately. Its co-director and star is conservative writer Dinesh D'Souza. He travels to Hawaii, Indonesia, and Kenya, where he tests his theory. And this week, D'Souza's film could be seen in one of 1,500 theaters across America. Now, many critics have blasted the conspiratorial tone of the film, which D'Souza calls a documentary. I spoke to him this week. Here's an excerpt of our conversation, and I first asked him to explain what he means when he argues that the president is trying to weaken America.
He wants America to have less wealth and power so that other people in other countries can have more wealth and power.
All right, let's assume that maybe some of your arguments are in fact true. Why would he be doing this?
Obama is an anti-colonialist. He has a dream, and it's the dream from his father. Anti-colonialism generally is based on the premise that the Western countries, and now the United States, have become rich by invading and occupying and looting the poor countries, so that the wealth of the world is unfairly distributed. And what Obama wants to do is correct that. How do you correct it? You correct it ultimately by making sure that the previously colonized countries have better access to growth and power. And if there's a cost for that, you put the cost on the colonizers, in this case, the United States.
Let's go through some of the arguments you raise in the film, because, of course, I have seen the film, and you seem to hold his background, his African father and his mother, who was from Kansas originally. You seem to hold these things against him. President Obama has never hidden his past, where he comes from, his background. I wonder if that's fair. I mean, he doesn't have any control over who his father was or who his mother was?
Oh, right. I would not normally hold Obama accountable for the views of either his father or his mother had he not written a book detailing how influential his father and also to some degree his mother have been on him. So I'm simply following Obama's story. Look, it's odd for Obama defenders to say he's a multicultural guy, he's different, he's not like any president we've had before, and then say, well, but it's illegitimate to ask how multicultural he is, how different he is, in what way he is different from traditional Democrats like Clinton or Kerry or Carter or Dukakis. I think Obama is different from traditional Democrats in that traditional Democrats want to redistribute income in America, while Obama wants to realign America in the world.
At several times in the film, we hear President Obama reading from his book, Dreams from My Father, including a passage where he describes how he was attracted to left-wing students, to structural feminists and others, foreign students, as a young college student. But you exclude the part of the book that explains how he eventually rejected those ideas. The whole point of the book is about his transformation. Why did you omit that?
I don't agree that Obama rejected the beliefs of his college years. It would be different if Obama had said as an adult, well, you know what, I had some crazy beliefs when I was a kid. I hung out with some unsavory characters, but I now reject all that. I've learned better. I've changed my mind. But Obama has never repudiated his book. He's never taken back the points that he made there.
David Walker, the former head of the GAO, was interviewed in this film about the debt. I called him and I asked him what he felt about it. He says that when he was asked to be interviewed, the film was misrepresented to him. Did everybody you interview know what this film was going to be about?
I think so. Now, look, the interview with David Walker was on the specific topic of debt. And I don't attribute to David Walker the argument of the film or even my view that Obama uses debt as a form of global redistribution. So we don't misrepresent him in any way. He doesn't claim we do. And also, in a film being a journey, there are people in the film who like Obama. You know, Alice Dewey, the anthropologist in the film, ended our interview by saying, hey, I hope Obama does get reelected.
Was she aware of what you were, the direction in which you were going? This is a professor at the University of Hawaii.
Right. We said we were making a film that was going to look closely at Obama's life and look at Obama's world and say what the world would look like if Obama were to be reelected. And on that basis, she was quite happy to be interviewed.
And Dinesh D'Souza, if you wanted to criticize or attack President Obama, why bend the truth? Why not just offer a policy critique rather than conjecture and, in many cases in this film, conspiracy?
This is not a matter of conjecture. This is a matter of having an ideological hypothesis that comes right out of Obama's book. And by laying it forward, people who watch the film can make up their own mind.
That's Dinesh D'Souza. His new film is called 2016 Obama's America. Dinesh D'Souza, thank you.
You're welcome.
And you can hear our full unedited conversation at npr.org.
What's up?
Okay, if you're under 25 and you're listening, for those of us who aren't, we're about to discuss some vocabulary that Boston Globe language columnist Ben Zimmer says you already know. Ben Zimmer, let's do this thing. YOLO?
YOLO.
YOLO. It's an acronym that stands for You Only Live Once. And Ben Zimmer says it's the buzzword of the year for teenagers and young adults.
Especially after a song, The Motto, by the rapper Drake, came out.
Now she want a photo. You already know, though. You only live once. That's the motto. YOLO, and we bought it every day, every day, every day.
When the video came out in February, all of a sudden YOLO was everywhere.
And that's where it started?
Well, you can find precursors, definitely. I mean, the full expression, you only live once, goes back a
long way.
That's
not new, right? Yeah.
Not at all, no.
Yeah.
But this year is really the year of YOLO, thanks to that song, The Motto, and how it then spread.
Now she want a photo. You already know, though. You only live once. That's the motto. YOLO, and we bought it.
It's a fascinating shibboleth, an expression that really marks one group from another. If you're young, you know YOLO. In fact, YOLO seems to encapsulate something about youthful behavior, sort of crazy, reckless behavior, and living that way without worrying too much about the consequences.
So, so how would you use it, for example?
You could say, you know, I got so wasted last night, YOLO. That would be a sort of a retrospective YOLO, talking about something that happened in the past.
A more thoughtful YOLO.
A more thoughtful YOLO. Well, you know, you could be weighing different decisions. You want to park illegally in this spot? YOLO. Should I buy these shoes or pay rent? YOLO. So it can just get tacked on that way. It can also be used as a verb. You can talk about YOLOing as a way to talk about expressing that youthful vitality, let's say.
Ben, YOLO, I would suspect, is going to have a short shelf life because I understand that Katie Couric, when she launches her new talk show, is going to have a segment called What's Your YOLO, which is quite possibly the fastest way to make that term uncool.
What Katie Couric is doing with this segment is encouraging viewers to write in or make videos that they submit to the show talking about what's the thing that you want to do before you die? What do you want to cross off your bucket list?
So she's turned YOLO into bucket list.
Right. So that YOLO expression, the way she's using it, is turning into something else, and certainly nothing related to that kind of youth culture that it came out of. So if Katie Couric is latching on to it, that may really signal the death knell of YOLO.
See, I was always under the impression of YOLT.
You only live twice.
You only live twice, right?
You only live twice.
Right, so that was the James Bond novel, which turned into the movie with the Nancy Sinatra theme song. It was recently used on the show Mad Men. When that song was on the show in June, there were people who were making that connection between YOLO, You Only Live Once, and YOLT, You Only Live Twice.
You only live twice.
What's up? What's up?
That's Ben Zimmer, language columnist for the Boston Globe. He recently wrote about the term YOLO. Ben, YOLO.
YOLO.
Now she want a photo. You already know, though. You only live once. That's the motto. YOLO. And we bout it every day, every day, every day. Like we sitting on the bench. But we don't really play every day, every day. But anybody say, can't see him because the money in the way. Real. What's up?
On this program, we've been asking filmmakers, actors, writers, and directors about the movies that they could watch over and over again, including this one from one of the stars of Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bell. I am an actress, and the movie I have seen a million times is Wet Hot American Summer, directed by David Wayne, starring Paul Rudd, Amy Poehler, Bradley Cooper, Michael Ian Black, Elizabeth Banks, Janine Garofalo, and David Hyde Pierce.
Good morning, everybody. Well, it's the last day of camp.
I saw it when I was living in New York. I didn't know anything about it. I just saw this weird vintage-looking billboard, and I thought, oh, this might be funny. And I went in and absolutely had the time of my life.
Well, we made it to the end of the summer in one piece, except for a few campers who are lepers.
The film is about one summer on a campground where each portion of the campers' lives is represented between the love connections with the counselors.
I love the way you laugh, and I love the way your hair smells, and I love it that sometimes for no reason you're late for shul. And
the camp director who can't get it together.
Katie, you're hot, right?
I suppose so.
Okay, so if one wanted to be hot and you make a good impression, what would you wear? You put on a clean pair of pants?
The chef who may or may not be poisoning everyone.
I finish up the taters. I'm going to go fondle my sweaters.
Come on, what?
Finish up the taters.
You said you were going to go fondle your sweaters.
No, I didn't. I said I'm going to fondue with cheddar. I was thinking about making fondue with cheddar cheese for dinner tonight.
And it's basically about one crazy summer of everybody trying not to get killed.
Earlier today, I saw what I thought was possibly a planet. I now believe that object was none other than a renegade piece of Skylab, the NASA space station, and it's heading right for the camp.
There is one scene where Liz Banks is eating a barbecue.
Is there any more corn?
What?
Paul Rudd's character is kind of in love with her, and she's eating these barbecue wings, and she's got barbecue sauce all over her face, but she's the babe.
Oh, dude, Lindsay, you got...
What, dude?
You have barbecue sauce all over your face.
She just has all this disgusting barbecue sauce up her nose and dripping off her chin, and she's doing it so sexily.
It's pretty foul.
It's just barbecue sauce. Come on, I want to make out.
I loved that it danced this line of being so familiar and relatable and real, yet being absolutely ridiculously comedic and out of this world and broad.
Hey, let's all promise that in 10 years from today, we'll meet again, and we'll see what kind of people we've blossomed into.
Yeah!
What time you want to meet?
You mean 10 years from now?
Yeah.
Let's meet in the morning so we can make a day of it.
Conventional comedy isn't always necessarily the funniest, because this movie is weird and experimental, and David Wayne clearly made a movie that he liked, and that's why I love it.
In this wet American summer.
That's actress Kristen Bell talking about the movie that she could watch a million times, Wet Hot American Summer. Bell's new film is called Hit and Run, and it's in theaters now. And it's time now for music.
And pain is all around, like
Paul Simon was because the writer Art Garfunkel was the voice, and together they created songs that could easily be called American classics, like this one.
Like a bridge over troubled water.
Both men are now 70 years old. They once sang about how terribly strange it would be to be 70. Their sometimes difficult relationship has been pretty well documented, but the two men have now made their peace. So it's fitting that Art Garfunkel has just released a retrospective. It's called The Singer, and it includes some of his best work as a solo artist and also as part of Simon & Garfunkel. And oddly, for a man in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Art Garfunkel says he put this collection together because he felt like his work hadn't been recognized.
Because you might have thought, Guy, he is recognized. People
right.
know Artie. He's the guy yeah. with the singing voice.
Yeah.
Sometimes I look at Joni Mitchell, Van Morrison, artists that win their respect after years and decades of hanging in. I wondered if I was being seen that way. I know I'm half of Simon & Garfunkel. Okay, I'm the singer, but I wanted to be a virtuoso singer. I wanted to be a singer in the same way that Bill Evans is a piano player, and it's tough to name many singers who are treating their vocals as a virtuoso instrument. But I want people to go from song to song and listen to the sequencing of the songs and end up going, "The singer can sing." Singing is an expression of love. You form it in the vocal cords when you love your song and you lose yourself into the song. It's very tough to analyze the act of singing.
The two of you recorded your first record, Wednesday Morning 3 a.m. It was released in 1964. Of course, the song off that record that is still with us more than any other, Sounds of Silence.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping.
It's remarkable, not just lyrically, but the sound of that song is so much more mature than the ages of the singers and the singer and the writer at the time.
How about the very mentality of Paul Simon? This is a very interesting Paul Simon with a mind that can reach into the future. And I am a spiritual partner. When you sing with a partner and he has a very pleasing sound and he's your friend and you laugh a lot, you soon start making music with the heads very close to each other, the noses almost touching. And you study the diction. And you create over your two heads a little bubble of reality and sound. When I work with Paul, I go into that dome, that invisible, small circumference dome, and revisit that place. And it's apart from life on Earth. It's its own very pleasing soundscape.
People talking without speaking. People hearing without listening. People writing songs that voices never share. No one dare disturb the sound of silence.
That song didn't get a lot of attention immediately, which is hard to imagine today. It took, about a year and a half before people started to notice it, and then it became a hit.
There was a Sony, a Columbia Records in those days, promotion man who worked the Florida coast and who said, there's a cult forming around the Sound of Silence. And in New York, they overdubbed electric 12-string, the sound of the time, and bass and drums, and they turned it into from a folky thing with one guitar. They made a rock and roll record with a nice twang, a la The Byrds, Mr. Tambourine Man. It fit the sound of that season. It slowly changed my life.
and the sign flashed out its warning in the words that it was forming. And the sign said the words of the prophets are written on the subway walls, the tenement halls, whispering sounds of silence.
I'm speaking with Art Garfunkel. He just released a record called The Singer. It's a retrospective album covering music from Simon and Garfunkel and also from his solo career. After the breakup of Simon and Garfunkel, you, of course, went on to your own very successful solo career. What was your hope when you went out on your own? Did you feel like, now I need to prove something?
Well, basically, yes. I started in the early 70s making Angel Clare, my first solo album with Roy Halley, and I remember my thinking there in San Francisco. The producer's role fell in my lap. I was the one who stroked and tinkered with the So Long Frank Lloyd Wright and all these various songs. So I hoped in my solo work to produce my records with grooves, the backing tracks that made you feel it's the same lovely crafted thing that we know from Simon and Garfunkel. And now I'll put the vocal in without the harmony and try and show that I can sing good.
When I run dry, I stop a while and think of you.
Of course, you miss these great songs of Paul Simon's. You miss his brilliant guitar playing. What a great rhythm guitar player Paul is. And you miss these elements. You miss the electricity that lights up the recording session and makes it all fun and games and makes the night go on for many extra hours because partnership is juicy.
Let's say in 40 or 50 years from now, when people are talking about the great American songbook and...
Will I be there? Am I in there? Am I in this scenario?
And somebody says, Art Garfunkel, what do you want people to remember you for?
I want them to say, there he is. He's rocking on his chair. See at the end of the veranda. How old must this guy be? I don't know, but he's still with us. What do I want them to remember? That we were good. We were the real thing. We recorded as if a record was an important thing. It wasn't digital impulses streamed past people's consciousness. It was a record. They were 4 minutes long. They had beginning, middles, and ends, and when they were great, they were like masterpieces. I want to be in that world of a real artist.
It's Art Garfunkel. He just released a new retrospective collection called The Singer. It includes songs from Simon and Garfunkel all the way up to recently recorded tracks from his solo career. Art Garfunkel, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure having you on.
It was very nice sitting here and talking with you, Guy. Thanks for your interest.
And here's to you, Mrs. Robinson. Jesus loves you more than you will know. Robinson, heaven holds a place for those who pray.
For the week ending September 2nd, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. This week, our program was directed by Phil Harrell and Brent Bachman. Our production staff includes Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Brenda Salinas, Caitlin Dickerson, and Amy Held. Mathoni Maturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. Until then, thanks for tuning in.